I only have covered a brio.
The same with that. Okay. I was talking about Steve. All right. So this week and next, we'll discuss Megillas Esther in anticipation of Purim. You know, Laura, if you can't hear me in the back, you may want to just come forward a bit. So the Gemara says in Chulin Daf Kuflam Etesam Bez, very famous Gemara, Esther min Atar Minayin, I think it's Rosh Lakish. Chulin Daf Kuflam Etesam Bez, Esther min Atar Minayin, where do we find a reference to Esther from the Torah? Of course, the question itself is strange, because Esther lived long after the Torah was written and given to the Jewish people. So the Gemara answers that the Torah has a phonetically related pasuk. Vonochi haster astir aspanai bayomahu. God says, Moshe told the people in Vayelech, there'll come a time in the future when I will surely conceal my presence from them. When God's presence is concealed and God's hand in history operates mysteriously, covertly, that is really a reference to Esther. So, of course, not a reference to Esther directly, it's a reference to Megillas Esther and the story of Esther. That the story of Esther is one of Hester Panim. When Hashem operates behind the scenes and his hand comes through magnificently, if a person understands the clues and the signs, but really there's no extraneous event in the Megillah, and everything points to the manifestation of Hashem's presence. This is clear really in every story, in every detail, every particular, but one I want to look at today, and that is the very short, seemingly insignificant vignette of the attempted rebellion, the conspiracy of Bigson and Zeresh. So it's found at the end of Perek Beis in the Megillah. Perek Beis, Pasuk Chaf Aleph. To set the time and place, Esther has already been chosen as the new queen of Persia, Ahasuerus' treasured wife. Ein Esther Magedes Molatov Es Amo. Esther did not reveal her origin, really her true identity, or her origin, her people. Kasher Tzivo Alo Mordechai, as Mordechai commanded her. And again, just like she did when she lived with Mordechai, she continued to obey Mordechai in everything he said. Now, that of course plays a very important role, as well as the following. In those days, bless you, Mordechai is sitting in the gate of the king. Now, the Gemara says, it's a Medrash. No, it's the Medrash says that Esther, as one of her first orders of business as the queen of Persia, told Ahasuerus that he would be wise to appoint someone, a Jew, who can be trusted as his eyes and ears in the kingdom. Just like Nebuchadnezzar had done, Nebuchadnezzar had appointed Daniel as his vizier, so too Ahasuerus should appoint a Jew, and she recommended a very learned and respected Jew, having her husband, Mordechai. And that's why Mordechai was elevated to this position, Mordechai Yoshev B'Shar HaMelech. To be sitting in the gates of the king is not just to be a luftmensch, have nothing to do, it's not like a bus stop, but we know from the rest of Tanakh, the Shar HaMelech was really the place where business was conducted and transactions took place and the intrigue of the kingdom was revealed. If you think to the Book of Rus, when Boaz wanted to announce that he was going to marry Rus, he took her to the Shar HaMelech, where the Zkenim sat. So that's the place where business was conducted, the courts met. In the context of the king, it's where the business of the kingdom was conducted. Remember, of course, we're talking about despotic rule, tyrannies. So it's not as if there's an active legislature as such, but just like we say about a legislature, someone has a seat in the Congress or a seat in the Parliament, to have a seat in the Shar Melech meant you were a player, you were privy to the intrigues of governance, you were on some level an advisor of the king, and therefore it was a prestigious position. All that leads to the following. U'morachai Yoshev b'Shar Melech, Kotzaf b'Gson v'Seresh Shnei Sarisei HaMelech Mishomrei Asaf, two servants of the king, two chamberlains of the king, B'Gson and Seresh, were mentioned in the first parak, I believe, yes. Well, at least one of them is, B'Gson. Sarisei HaMelech, chamberlains of what nature we'll discuss, they became angry. Now, they were Mishomrei Asaf, literally guardians of the threshold. Saf is a threshold, but it has a dual meaning. So they became angry for unspecified reasons. Vayivakshu l'shloach yod b'melech Achashverosh. And they desired to plot against the king, to extend their hand against the king Achashverosh, to kill him. How do they want to kill him? So Rashi says they wanted to poison him. Yes.
One of them was the baker, and the other one, the second one,
Pitam
was the baker.
No, that's the story of Yosef.
No,
in here. He was the baker, and the other one was
the butler.
Right. That's how it's connected to the story of Yosef.
All right, the Gemara says connected another way, which we'll discuss in a moment. Vayivoda hadavar leMordechai. Mordechai found out. Vayaged leEsther haMalka. And he related this to Esther the queen. How did he find out? So Rashi says that they were Tarsians, and they spoke in their native tongue, Bigson and Seresh did, and Mordechai, being a member of the Sanhedrin, one of whose prerequisites was the knowledge of all 70 languages, so therefore he understood what they were saying in this exotic tongue. Vatomer Esther LaMelech v'shem Mordechai. Mordechai then told Esther. I'm sorry. Mordechai told Esther. Esther then told the king, v'shem Mordechai, in Mordechai's name. From this Chazal derive famously in the fifth parak of Avos, Kol Omer Davar b'shem Omro, Mevi Geula LaOlam. A person who relates something to another in the name of the originator brings redemption to the world. How do we know this? From here. Vatomer Esther LaMelech, v'shem Mordechai. Esther said to the king what happened in Mordechai's name. Vayivukash hadavar vayimotzei. The matter was investigated and corroborated. Vayitalu shnehem al eitz. Both of them were hanged on the tree. Vayikasev b'sefer divrei hayamim b'fnei haMelech. And Mordechai's deed was recorded in the king's book of Chronicles. So mevi gula l'olam, at the beginning of the sixth parak, v'layla hahu nodod al shnas haMelech, the king, who in any event was paranoid, could not sleep, so he ordered lavi sefer hazichronos divrei yamim, the book of Chronicles was brought, he asked that it be read to him, and he read of this account, v'yimotzei chosuv asher higid Mordechai al biksonov oseresh, shnei sarisei haMelech mishamrei asaf, he read of this event, which had happened years earlier. What great honor, what greatness was bestowed on Mordechai for this deed of heroism? Nothing was done, and the story unfolds. So maybe gula la'olam. The Mefarshim asked the obvious question. Very nice, Kol Omer Dov B'Shem Omer Mevi Gul Olam. But that's this case. Where do we see it in other cases? If you quote someone and don't name the origin of the quote, the originator of the quote, granted you're a plagiarist, but if you do it, so where do you find that you achieve redemption from this but through this story? It means every time I quote someone and mention his name, redemption is coming. What exactly do Chazal mean by that? I want to understand what happened here. Of course, the significance of the story, as trivial as it seems, when it happens, even Mordechai was not fully aware of its dimensions and how it would play out later in the story, Perek Vav, what exactly happened? What was the plot? Why did the plot arise? What was the significance of the plot? Who were Bigson and Zeresh? What was their grievance against the king? How do we understand this Maimer of Chazal, Kol Omer, Dover B'Shem Omer, Mei Vigula L'Olam? And perhaps, I guess the unspoken question that we don't often ask. Achashverosh was a Rasha. Mar says openly he was a Rasha. He had seized Mordechai's wife and was living with his wife. Why did Mordechai just let Achashverosh be killed? Why did he intervene? He could have let Achashverosh be killed, let the conspiracy take place, let him be poisoned. Achashverosh is dead. His wife returns to him, and as far as they know, they live happily ever after. So why did he intervene to save Achashverosh's life? Anyone ever think of that question before? It never dawned on me until this morning. Well, she was saved. Batilokah. She was seized. She was not. She did not go. Unlike the other women, she did not go voluntarily. She was taken by force. So why did Mordechai? No. That's one thing that he had an inkling, but he had no idea. That's one thing that we live with in Tanakh. You know, we know the end of the story, so it all makes sense. You know, sure, you're kidnapped, it's fine, it'll all work out. Called on Rahman al-Tavavid. But trust me, when they were living through it, they did not know about it. Like, Yaakov did not know what happened to Yosef. He had 22 years of torment. He did not know what happened. We know because we read the Torah every year. He did not know. Yes. That's a possibility. That's correct. That's one possibility. Now, that would be in a nationalistic context. Better the evil that you know than the evil that you don't know, which you know most governments adopt as their policy. But there was a personal dimension here as well. And no doubt, Mordechai, on some level, would have benefited from Esther's liberation and Achashverosh's death. Not to mention the fact that Achashverosh had already halted the building of the Beis HaMikdash. So it's not as if he was a friend of the Jews. On the contrary, you see, he was an enemy of the Jews before, and certainly Perek Gimel, when he says to Haman, yeah, do whatever you want, he doesn't really care about them one way or the other. So why did Mordechai not just let the plot unfold?
Was he taking married women too, by the way?
He was not taking married women. That was the uniqueness of Esther, which we discussed in the past. There's something about Esther that attracted his fancy. Something about him. What the Megillah refers to as Vati Esther Noseis Chain. Let me see. It's Perek Beis, Pasuk Tezva. Vati Esther Noseis Chain Beinei Kol Ro'eh. She had Chain, which is an indefinable quality. Grace. It's not necessarily beauty. And we've discussed, the Gemara says that Esther Yerak Rokes Hoyo Hava. She had a green complexion. Which, whatever it is, doesn't sound good from our perspective, that she was not the natural beauty, you know, unlike the way the kids dress up today. She was not, the Gemara says. So it's a different aspect, as you find, not, you know, people have chayin. Chayin very often makes a person beautiful. Conversely, by the way, a woman who's physically attractive but lacks chayin becomes rapidly unattractive as well. So chayin is that quality that drew her to Achashverosh. Let's understand. Perek Gimel begins, by the way, Achar Hadvarim Ho'ele, after these events. So Rashi says these events are twofold. One, Esther's appointment as the, or selection as the queen. And secondly, Mordechai's incident with Bigson and Zeresh, his revelation of their conspiracy. Now the Gemara says in Megillah, Daf Yud Gimel Amud Bez, really introducing, Achar Dvar Maila, Gidal HaMelech Achashverosh. After what? So the Gemara says, Achash Shabor HaKadosh Baruch Hu V'Higdim Refu'o L'Mako. After God created the situation, in other words, created the cure before the disease, that's when the problems of Haman and the attempted extermination of the Jews took place. There was a refuah that was put in place first. Damar Rish Lakish said, Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu Makes Yisrael Elim Kein Magdim Uvarei Lehem Refuah B'tchila. God never smites the Jewish people unless first there's a refuah, there's some type of cure, some therapy, some escape route already in place before the dastardly deed arises. And that is a truism of Jewish history. That, Chazal say here, is the Derech Hashgacha. The Jewish people are never left without an option. We always have an option. So, for example, by the time the expulsion from Spain took place, already Eastern Europe and Asia Minor, North Africa became hospitable to Jews. For that matter, Eretz Yisrael as well, under the rule of the Turkish Sultan. By the time European Jewry had collapsed in the 30s, you had both America and really the land of Israel as havens in the preceding almost half century. So God is always borei refuah lemako. Before one door closes, another door opens. It's not even as if to say when the door closes, then another opens. No, that's what the Gemara says. Before a door closes, another door has already opened. Like the saying goes, opportunity knocks. But when opportunity knocks, I think it was Franklin who said, you have to be sure to be near the door to answer it. So when a door opens, you have to want to walk through that door and not say, I'm waiting for another door, or a wider door, or a gate, or some other place, which is a historical problem that the Jewish people have. So in fact, that's what it means. That's the Derech Hashgacha. That's how Kadosh Baruch Hu deals with us. Before a door closes, Hashgacha moves events forward in such a way that the providence ordains there be another door through which we could walk. Here, it's the exact same thing. God already put in place the infrastructure whereby the salvation of the Jewish people would take place, and something else, probably even more important, which we'll discuss at the very end, is something else which really underlies the whole story, which we also don't think about too much, of Purim, but we should. God already put that infrastructure in place with Esther in the palace as the king's wife and Mordechai Yoshev Bishar HaMelech. So what happened here? So now the Gemara continues. Bayamim Ohem uMordechai Yoshev Bishar HaMelech. In those days, Mordechai was sitting in the gate of the king. Katzaf Bigson Vaseresh. Bigson and Seresh became angry. Why did they become angry? Amar Chia Barabo, Amar Yochanan. Sigmar Megillah, Daf Yud Gimel, days again. Hiktzif HaKadosh Baruch Hu Adonim Al Avadim Lasos Ritzon Tzadik. God caused the master to become angry at his servants in order to fulfill the will of the righteous one. V'avadim Adonihem Lasos Nes Tzadik. And he also caused the servants to become angry at the master in order to perform a nes for the tzadik. What are these two cases? So this is the reference to Yosef. Because you have parallel, although reverse, events. In the Sedra Vayeshev, it says, Paro kotzaf al avodov. Paro became angry at his servants. Now, it's unusual, to say the least, that a dictator becomes angry at anybody. Why? Dictators have the luxury of never having to become angry. They just, as soon as they're displeased with someone, they kill him. They don't have to get themselves into a fit of anger. Yet, here, in Vayeshev, Paro Kotzaf al Avadov, against the Sahar Mashkim and the Sahar Ofim, also for something frivolous. Frivolous, some error that may or may not have even been their fault, Paro became angry. All for the purpose of Lasos Ritzon Tzadik, in order to set events into motion that would lead to the liberation of Yosef from prison. Here, the exact opposite happens, although the same basic principle. Avadim al Adonayim. Kotzaf bigson vaseresh. Note the same word is used. Paro kotzaf al avadov. And here, kotzaf bigson vaseresh. Kotzaf, by the way, is not just kas. Kotzaf is rage. They became enraged. Paro, again, unusually, became enraged against his two sarim, Bigson and Seresh, who were lowly people, bodyguards. They became enraged against Achashverosh. Dichsiv, Katsaf, Bigson Vaser, Shnei Sar Sehamelech, Mishamray Asav, all Lasos Neis Latzadik. So God should be able to perform a miracle through this righteous person. Who's the righteous person? Mordechai. Dichsiv Vaivoda Hadavor LeMordechai. All this became known to Mordechai, their conspiracy, etc. So there was Shomrei Asaf, guardians of the household. What exactly was their role? And then we'll try to understand why exactly they became angry. What was their role? So let's just read the Gemara. All right, the first things first. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Bikson Vaseresh Tarsiyim Havu. They were Tarsians from Tarsus. V'ahayu Misaprin Lashon Tursi. They spoke that language amongst themselves. Amar Zelazer, they said to each other, Miyom Shebos Zo, from the time this woman came to the king's palace, Lo Ra'inu Sheino Be'enenu. We can't get a moment's sleep. Why? So Rashi says, Lo Ra'inu Sheino Mitoch Shehoisa Chaviva Olov, Hoyamarbe V'tashmish Amita V'tzomei Lishtos. He, Ahasuerus, was so enamored with Esther that he kept her up the whole night, pleasuring himself. So he was alternately drinking and pleasuring, and they had to minister to him. They couldn't sleep, and they got tired of it. They hadn't slept. Bo v'natil eresh shel sam misa b'seifel shomayim k'dei sheyamos. Let us go put a poison, so liquid poison, into his bowl of water so he'll die. That was the plan. V'heim lo yadu she'Mordechai miyoshvei lishkas hagozes hoya v'yodeh shivim l'shanos. They didn't know that Mordechai was one of those who sat in the Sanhedrin. Lishkas hagozes was the chamber of the hewn stone where the Sanhedrin sat in the base of Mikdash. So it's a little anachronistic, but in fact, all the Chazal is saying, yoshvei lishkas hagozes is a member of the Sanhedrin. V'yodeh shivim l'shanos. He knew 70 languages. That so that the members of the Sanhedrin should be able to hear a witness testify in his native tongue. Whenever an interpreter is used, something is always lost. However you look at it, something is lost. What's that? Lost in translation. That's correct. I don't know if you follow these things, but when Lynn Stewart was convicted a month ago, she was this crazy lawyer that I remember already from my days. I used to see her in court on occasion, always representing anarchists. But convicted along with him was one of the official court translators, who apparently was doing more than translating, who was passing messages to the terrorist network. But you'll find another case where a similar thing happened, that the translator did not translate the words of the witness verbatim, but rather colored it, so it should look better for the person who was trying to favor. In any event, translations always lose something, and therefore, the Sanhedrin... those who sat on the Sanhedrin had to understand verbatim the 70 languages. Omar Leis, so this is what Mordechai heard. He heard the plan, and then he heard the problem of the plan. One said to the other, V'halo ein mishmarti mishmarti chashava. We don't have the same tasks. We don't perform the same role. So how are we supposed to conspire together? Rashi says, Ani mimune al avoda achas, v'ata mimune al avoda acheres. I'm in charge of one thing, you're in charge of something else. So how is it possible for the two of us to coordinate, especially to coordinate in such a way that nothing will be amiss, that will attract attention to ourselves and abort the plot before it's executed? Omar Lei, so one said to the other, Ani eshmor mishmarti u'mishmartecha. I will therefore take care of my position and at the appointed time, take care of yours as well. That's what the pasuk says. The matter was investigated. Literally, something was found. What was found? That someone was not found at his post. When the person was not found at his post, so they investigated, and they determined that he was not there because he was conspiring with the other. And that's how it was uncovered. So Rashi says, without elaboration, they had different jobs. The problem with Rashi, as the Marshal points out, is, so what? They had different jobs. All that means, they couldn't work together? Why can't they work together? you devise a plan whereby you're able to utilize whatever tasks you have, and you together enable the conspiracy to unfold. Like, for example, when the Nazi officers tried to kill Hitler. So they had one colonel smuggle in, it was July 1944, smuggle in a briefcase filled with explosives. That's what he did, and as things happened, someone kicked it, and it was moved. He had put it on the side of the table where Hitler was, I'd say the left side of the oak support for the large table, and this guy kicked it and moved the other side of the support. And because of that, mainly the table blew up, Hitler was injured, the count, the colonel himself was injured, was executed the next day in any event. But in fact, what do? They took a guy, how do you get close to him? It had to be someone who had access, it had to be in a way which would not arouse suspicion. So everybody came with briefcases. The same thing here. Why couldn't they figure out a way in which, even though they had different jobs, so you do different things. The Marsha has a different approach. And he said they had the same job. Same job. There was Shomrei Asaf. Now, Shomrei Asaf has two meanings. Either guardians of the threshold, which is the external part of the palace, or literally the door of the palace. Whether it's outside, meaning the outer gate, doesn't seem likely, but let's say the inner gate of the palace. And if you visit the palaces, there are always guards, both at the front gate and at every intersection in the palace, and certainly the front door. Let's say there was Shomrei Asaf, there was the threshold of the door. But Saf has another meaning in Tanakh. Saf is also like a seifel, a cup. So according to this, they were in charge of the king's cup to bring him water. And this will come into effect in the next shot too. But they had two different roles. The Marsha says not that they had different jobs. They're the same job but different shifts. That's what it means. Ein mishmarti mishmarta chashava. Mishmar is a guardian post. Their stations were different in the sense that they worked different shifts. So, according to the Gemara, it looks like they had two shifts, the tyrants. They worked 12-hour shifts. But let's assume for a moment 8-hour shifts. So, obviously, if the night guard night watchman comes to the day guard's post, something is off. So that's what they said. If I work the day shift and you work the night shift, first of all, how could they discuss with each other? It's a separate point. Let's assume there were three shifts. If they meet, people wonder, why is the night shift person with the morning person? Or the morning, they're supposed to be consecutive, not together. So that, the Marsha, is the problem they had to work out. They would attract, they would attract.
Follow the staying up all night logic of anger, though.
What's that?
It doesn't follow the logic of staying up all night, being kept up ministering to him.
Yes, that's correct. So the Marsha doesn't discuss why they've lost sleep, except for the fact that if you're working a 12-hour day, with a king known for his
excess,
not just excesses, but his caprice. So it's a stressful position, which does not lend itself to much sleep. We'll discuss that in a moment, though. So Marsha said, "What's the solution?" He said, "Ani yeshvom mishmartu mishmartacha." Now you notice, if you've gone even to Buckingham Palace or any of the palaces in Europe, the guards always wear uniforms. And the uniforms, especially at night, are very, very difficult to tell them apart because they have a head covering. In some places, they even have a mask, like the Knights wore. So he says, one said to the other, "You will go and bring the poison, and I'll just stand in your place." And that's what the Marsha said. The Ben Yoyoda is a different shot. And the Ben Yoyoda said that they had related jobs. And that's that Ein Mishmarti Mishmarta Chashava. That the king really had two needs at night as he was with Esther. One, as he exhausted himself, he needed constantly to be replenished with water. So someone had to bring him pitchers of water on a consistent basis. That was the job of one of them, say Bigson. What happens when you drink water? You have to relieve yourself. So of course there's no indoor plumbing. The job of the other one was to bring a seifel, a bowl, for the king to relieve himself. So Ahasuerus is up the whole night, alternatively drinking and relieving himself. So they're going back and forth. That was their job. So now the problem was, how is it they had a real problem? Because let's say when one, we assume they couldn't carry the poison on their person the entire day, because they'd be searched, they'd be found out, etc. So the plan initially was that one of them would go in with the poison. The problem was they could not go in, the same person could not go in with different bowls. For obvious reason, the reason why it was kept separate was that one person handles the water bowl to drink, and the other handles the other bowl. And if that's how not only they kept the bowl separate, but they kept the people separate.
So why couldn't the one who went in with the bowl to drink just come in with the bowl with to drink with the poison in it?
He didn't have the poison.
So how are they going to get poison?
Ah, so this was the point. While they were waiting to be summoned, Ben Yoyada says the king had a bell. He had one bell for the water bowl and the other bell for the water bucket. All right? Now, what would happen? So one had to go out and get the poison. What would happen, though, if when he rang to get the water bowl, the person in charge of the water bowl had already left to get the poison? You can't have the water bucket service come in because already it would be suspicious. So that. What's that? Why they were tired.
So why would I go to the king rather than have and tell him they said a tired.
No, it could have worked. Well, the assumption is it could have worked.
Mordechai, having heard why they want to kill him, I would have all more reason to want to get rid of the Kashrus.
Because they said we can't sleep?
No, because
actually, government service, you don't sleep that much in any event.
No, I'm saying when he hears why they're not sleeping and what's happening to Esther, I would think more would incentive. Mordechai give more incentive
That's
to get
right.
rid of Ahasuerus.
That's right. So what was the plan then? So he said, Ani eshmor mishmarti mishmartecha, that I'll take it. So they were afraid. They were afraid that it would be uncovered by having...
Once he gets afraid, it's going to be a little while. If he gets afraid the next time.
Yes, but chalila v'chas, if the king then rings the bucket and the fellow's not there. So the other one said, don't worry about it. If it happens, I'll just go in and, you know, make some excuse. But that was their thought process, and it was these discussions that Mordechai overheard. The Malbim is a different pshat entirely. The Malbim says that they were jealous of Mordechai, because here everybody knew Mordechai HaYehudi, and here they are the king's bodyguards. They're trusted with the king's lives. They're his chamberlains. And yet, it's Mordechai who's appointed to be a Yoshev B'Shar HaMelech, not them. So they did not want, they resented having the Jew Mordechai sitting there while they're standing the whole day working. Now the Malbim says, importantly of course, that all this was min hashamayim. It's min hashamayim that they would dare to poison the king, because in fact the reason seems not only petty, but very personal. It does not seem worthy of an assassination attempt, because they can't sleep at night. They're losing sleep, they're going to kill the king. So what's going to happen? They'll kill the king. Well, no one's going to make the chamberlain, the guy who's in charge of the water bucket, the king. So what do they really gain from it? Nothing, really. And maybe they'll sleep a little more, or maybe they'll be sleeping with the fishes 2 days later. So what do they gain? Yet min hashamayim, that's what the Gemara means. Kotzaf bikson vaseresh. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hikzif HaKadosh Baruch Hu Avodim El Adonaihem. God caused them to become enraged in a way which was frivolous, because they would never rule. Now this itself points out a very interesting dimension about human life. It's hard to accept, in fact, that traumatic events can happen in history through the auspices of low lives or mishugayim. You see, I read once, makes a lot of sense. I'm convinced this is what fuels the Kennedy conspiracists, that it's hard for people to accept that a man like Kennedy, who's so admired, so respected, and so youthful and so vibrant, should be killed by a low life who had accomplished nothing. You wanted to be killed by for some great purpose, not because somebody had a grudge. Yes, that's correct. It turns out in American history, there's only one case that I could remember where an assassination attempt or successful assassination occurred for ideological reasons. And that was Booth, who killed Lincoln. It was the first time. Aside from that, Garfield was killed, McKinley was killed, Kennedy was killed. FDR was shot at when he was a president-elect. Reagan was shot at, Ford was shot at, almost all by Michigan. The first two, Garfield and McKinley, by people disgruntled because they didn't get the position they were seeking. Disgruntled office seekers, as the history books are called. So you find great people, presidents, involved in global affairs, affairs of state, they're felled by people of, how do we say it, tremendous insignificance. So therefore, you see, but this is where history operates. And Big Son and Sarash were basically moved by frivolous reasons, petty reasons. So you think it's unusual? On one level, it is unusual. But on a broader level, it makes a lot of sense. But all that points to the hand of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that Big Son and Sarash really had no objective reason to want to kill Ahasuerus. No objective reason. Certainly no reason that would play any role in terms of Jewish history. And yet, because of what they did, therefore, the whole process of Yeshua took place. I visited, actually, the Texas School Book Depository last summer. Walked the crime scene. And myself, you know, I'm convinced that Oswald did it, walked the grassy knoll. I don't subscribe to the theories at all. But outside, you have all the conspiracy theorists peddling their wares. The guy walks over and he wants to sell me a newspaper. He said, $10, you'll see who the real killer was.
Read the book, The Plot Against America, by Philip
Roth. Oh, Roth, okay. Well, I'll
Lindbergh,
tell you what I said to this fellow.
The Lindbergh kidnapping was really, you know, what would have happened.
Well, that's clearly, fiction.
What would have happened to the Jews
if Lindbergh
is president?
Right.
So he claims that the Lindbergh, it's part of conspiracy.
Well, but that is objectively fiction. This fellow says to me, do you want to know who really killed Kennedy? So I said, no, it's 40 years ago. How does it affect my life? And he looked at me with a puzzled look, and he walked away. That was the end of it. Because right now it doesn't affect anyone anymore. And yet, it doesn't rest. It doesn't rest because it's hard to accept that an Ahasuerus, a dictator, would be killed by a Big Son in Sarash. You want it to be killed by, you know, a foreign potentate, a disgruntled general, not by the Chamberlain. Just like you don't want to think that a Kennedy is going to be killed by an Oswald. Okay. So there's something else happens here also. What enrages Haman in the next parak? What does he see? Mordechai Yoshe B'Shar HaMelech. Here by Amin Lahem, U'Mordechai Yoshe B'Shar HaMelech. Now all the Jews see in Parak Gimel and beyond is Mordechai's obstinacy in that he refuses to stand up when Haman walks by. That's all they see. And as we know, Chazal said they're very critical of Mordechai for not doing that. Mordechai is Yoshe for his own reasons, and yet here's the irony. The fact that Mordechai is Yoshe B'Shar HaMelech, that's the Jews' criticism of Mordechai. But if Mordechai had not been Yoshe B'Shar HaMelech, he would not have been privy to the conspiracy of Big Son and Zeresh, and therefore the whole plot could not have unfolded.
What do you mean the Jews resented him for sitting?
Resented him.
The Jews resented him. They criticized Mar
said in Sanhedrin, they criticized Mordechai for endangering their lives.
By sitting in Shah HaMelech?
By sitting and not standing when the Haman came by.
Oh,
so if he had not been sitting there, Haman would not have had the predicate to kill them. By the same token, had he not been sitting there, this of course only revealed in retrospect, he would not have heard of the conspiracy of Big Son and Sarash. Thus you see, again, the clues, Esther Punim, the rebellion of Big Son and Sarash, by almost the accounts of all the Mefarshim, was personal and petty, and had nothing to do with affairs of state. And yet that set into motion the process of redemption. So now we ask, why didn't Mordechai let Ahasuerus die? So there are a few reasons. One was mentioned before, that Jews always favor stability. Being a minority, especially in Golos, we always favor stability. Better the devil you know than the devil you don't know, because whoever replaces the tyrant can always be worse. It's always possible that he should be worse. And because Jews have a predisposition to stability, That's why we're always trusted. That's why Jews universally became advisors to kings, not just with Nebuchadnezzar and Ahasuerus, but really down to our day. Jews almost never fomented rebellions against the king, except if you count the communist revolution, which Jews were disproportionately active, but those Jews were far from Torah. Torah Jews, you know, Dir Shu Shlom, Oir, Asher, Yirmiyahu said, you'll seek the peace of the city to which I've exiled you, pray for the wealth of the king, have Mispal Shlom Shlomachus, correct. That's why Jews were trusted. So therefore, Mordechai acted in that grand tradition of not being part of rebellion. Granted, of course, had it failed, had it been carried out and then stopped at the last minute, and it was revealed that Mordechai had known, so his place would have been destroyed also. Secondly, Mordechai already had an inkling that something was afoot. Like Ofer said before, Ariane said as well. Very strange that Esther, who's a married woman, older than the virgins who were brought before Ahasuerus, should be chosen as his queen. Once that happened, so Mordechai suspected something was afoot, and therefore, min hashamayim, something was afoot, that Esther being in the palace was good for the Jews, as long as she adhered to the line that the Mordechai said, which she did, the pasuk before our vignette, Vesmamar Mordechai Esther Oso Kasher Oso Famnoito, Esther remained as faithful to Mordechai and his guidance as she had when he raised her, so therefore Mordechai suspected that something was happening that would accrue to the advantage of the Jewish people. Thirdly, Mordechai knew something was up. That's the third reason. It was implausible that Esther would be selected on her own merits, and therefore he knew something had to be afoot, and of course that Esther in the palace was good for the Jews. So even though there was a personal loss to Mordechai, as we know from later in the Megillah, v'chasher avadati avadati, Mordechai accepted the personal loss of his wife for the greater good of Klal Yisrael. And something else happened here as well. This is the phrase we use in the davening that Novi mentions first. God's matzmiach keren Yeshua, matzmiach Yeshuos. What does it mean to be matzmiach? To plant, to sprout. Geula sprouts. Geula requires seeds. And that is the Yad Hashem. That's how the Hashgach operates. Through planting seeds. The seed of Esther in the palace. The seed of Mordechai b'Shar HaMelech. The seed of the conspiracy of Bigson and Seresh being revealed by Mordechai. All these things contribute ultimately to the process of redemption unfolding. And now we see something else as well. I can't go into too much detail to run, but Kol Omer Dover Shem Omer Mevigul Olam. Why is that? Esther comes and tells Ahasuerus in Mordechai's name. In fact, you see, when she did that, something else happened too. She so ingratiated herself to the king that now the king trusted her implicitly. Think about it. Esther's new to the palace. Now, and she sees from her home. She's not there willingly, necessarily. None of the girls were. And yet, the first opportunity that Esther has to reveal a conspiracy against the king, she does so. So now Ahasuerus trusts her completely, which, of course, when Esther comes later on, Ahasuerus is more than accepting of what she has to say. Rav Dessler writes in Michtam Elio Gula itself is built on an explosion of emes. You see, Kol Omer Dover Shem Omro is not just in cosmic matters. If a person quotes the Dvar Torah and doesn't mention the name of the originator of the thought, it's essentially is a bit of a lie that is encoded in his message. He's not telling the complete truth. Rav Dessler, in fact, mocks the British and now American formula. It's deviated somewhat today in American courts. That they swear in a witness, you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. So what's the difference between the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? You think, just say the truth, it should be enough. There is a difference that, the British and Americans recognize, which of course the Torah doesn't. The truth means the whole truth. Sometimes you could say the truth and leave out something which is detrimental, but then that's not the whole truth. MS stands by itself. And the gula has to be built on MS. as the Maharal writes in his Perush on Avos, Gulahi Hashavas Kol Ha'olam El Mikoro Ha'amiti. Gula is the return of the world to the source of truth, or to the true source, which is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So therefore, Gula means not only planting truth, but watching the sprouting of truth. And that's exactly what happened here. Because Esther told Ahasuerus, B'Shei Mordechai, so that's why Yeshua, the salvation, was planted. She secured her own position. And then something else happened as well. So we know from the story what happens. Great. The Yeshua comes nearer. But for Esther's telling Ahasuerus B'Shei Mordechai, it never would have been written in the Sefer Zichronos. And Ahasuerus never would have been able to repay Mordechai, and Haman came, etc., etc. But there's something else that happened here as well. The Yeshua, bless you, the Yeshua that came, or the danger that arose, sparked a renaissance of Jewish life. Tshuva. The Jews, by and large, were assimilated in Persian society. And now this danger arose, the threat came, and they realized they could not just blend in the society. They'd always be isolated as Jews. So in fact, when Mordechai and Esther concocted their scheme to save the Jews, it was predicated on one thing, and that was tshuva. For what purpose? Not just for Yeshua. The purpose of the tshuva was that so that the Jews should become worthy of Binyan Beis HaMikdash. That's what happened. The Binyan Beis HaMikdash had started and then stopped. Why did it stop? Like it always stops, or it never takes place. It's because we're not worthy of it. So Mordechai and Esther's plan really was twofold. One, of course, to save Klal Yisrael, but there was a second implicit plan as well, that tshuva would have another beneficial effect, and that would create a situation in Jewish life whereby the Binyan Beis HaMikdash would become possible. V'chein hoya, that's what happened. V'atomer Esther l'mech v'shem Mordechai, k'lomer dov v'shem o'mei v'gul olam. The gula is not just that they were saved. The gula was that the Beis HaMikdash was then built already in the life of Esther Hamalka after Ahasuerus died. And then the second Jewish commonwealth started in the land of Israel. That's really what underlies the story. The story starts implicitly with the stopping of the construction of Beis HaMikdash, and it ends implicitly with the Binyan Beis HaMikdash. And that's the real gula that takes place. That's what the planting of seeds accomplishes. That's what the Hashgacha sets into motion in ways which we cannot really understand ourselves, but only in retrospect can we look at it. And I've no doubt that the same thing in our day. When we look back after the gula comes, we'll be able to see events which seem trivial and insignificant at the time, but yet this person, that deed, that act of building, even this setback, all of which paved the road for the Gula Shleima. Thank you very much.
When Esther went to the king on her own accord,